Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Today we're talking about Book 8, Chapter 1 of The Brothers Karamazov. Then we'll be reading Book 8, Chapter 2. Yeah, that's right, Book 8, Chapter 2. The questions I asked you guys were these. Who is Kuzma Kuzmich? Probably a pretty basic question, but I'm kind of a bit lost. Who is Mitya again? I know there's three brothers. I know Alyosha, but the other two I just keep getting all mixed up. I know Mitya's one of them. One of them's angry, or both of them angry, or one of them's clever and one of them's not clever, or is the angry one the clever one? And I don't know. These characters are just like wafer thin to me. And the only way you get to know who they are is by the narrator just saying who they are, or them just saying their points of view about things, which just doesn't show you characters. That's not how you explain characters. So for me, I'm just not getting any sense of the characters. They just go straight through me. Anyway, that was the question I asked. Pretty legitimate question, although it seems like I might be taking the piss a bit, but I genuinely can't remember who Mitya is. I know it's Dmitri, but I don't know which one is Dmitri. And the third question was just general discussion. Swim said the mama fishy said, interesting, the property in question here is the same property that Fyodor wanted Ivan to take care of, lo, those many chapters ago, which Ivan blew off. The lines I liked best, but that is the way people like Dmitri Karamazov usually are about money. They only know how to spend it, how to throw it around, whatever they inherit, and have not the slightest notion how money is earned. I don't remember that line. And, for all his debauchery and vices, he was really a naive and childlike person. What a source, I don't remember that one. What an emotional whipsaw this book is. Are we reading the same book? I just do not understand. I don't understand what's going on here. People keep saying things like they're feeling emotions in this book. It's like reading a dictionary or something, except the dictionary is more interesting. Just random words. It's an emotional whipsaw. We've spent the last couple of weeks in the weeds after of faith and doubt, and now we are desperately looking for easy money to run off with Grushenka, who is preoccupied with issues of her own. I am Norwegian, said I remember Fyodor talking about that priest and how to read him, but I don't suppose that's who Dmitri is going to see. I'll post this on the off chance that Lurcher and Gortskin happens to be the same person. It will be fun if those tells become relevant again. Stay, wait a bit. You will be of use, for I will tell you the signs by which you can judge about Gortskin. I've done business with him long ago. You see, you must watch his beard. Oh, he's the guy that had the twitchy beard. I remember Musimov also having a dispute about woodcutting rights in the town near the monastery. Lots of wood-related disputes in the Brothers Karamazov. I am Norwegian says, Kuzma Kuzmich equals Samsonov. Samsonov is a wildly old businessman who becomes Grushenka's patron when she is dumped by her Polish boyfriend. By the time the novel begins, Grushenka is relatively independent of Samsonov, although he continues to mentor her in both her business and her love affairs. Mitya is Dmitri's nickname. The old man couldn't have been making a fool of me, could he? Oh, Mitya. We finally follow Dmitri again, and he is the same old conflicted and confused man, having neither the head of Ivan or the heart of Alyosha. It's kind of sad. But his own actions, he has put himself into a situation he cannot get out of. His only source of money is someone who he already owes money to, and that money carries a significance for his perception of himself. He cannot move forward until the debt is paid, and his soul is clear of that plight. But at the same time, he doesn't stand a chance with Grushenka anymore. She loved him for 1 hour and not more, and when he's not stumbling around digging these holes for himself, he is endlessly ruminating and torturing himself. Mitch's imagination got trapped again in his emotional turmoil, says Uncle Drosselmeyer. It is perfect how Dostoevsky describes Mitch's naivety and social awkwardness, proper of a man who has never done business before, and who takes us for granted everybody's complicity in the achievement of his laughable dreams. Also, it is heartbreaking how delusional he is about his relationship with Grushenka. Today's song, For No One by the Beatles. Cool. Laura Weistich said it's easy to start feeling sympathy for Dmitri, but he brought all these problems on himself by continuously spending all the money he had, including money that was not his own. And then there's the repeated suggestion that he's going to murder Fyodor, of course. Uncle Josimar said, yes, I agree. The guy is temperamental and irrational, the kind of guy you don't want to meet in real life. Okay. There we go. That's who Dmitri is. He's the one who's going to kill his father. And he's the one who is in the love triangle with Grushenka with his father, if I'm not mistaken. I don't know, really understand Grushenka's deal. Is she a prostitute? Is that what Grushenka is? Or what? I don't know. Don't know what's going on in this book. Chapter 2 is called Leah Gavi, and it goes like this. So, he must drive at full speed, and he had not the money for horses. He had 40 kopecks, and that was all. Who are we talking about here? Mitya? I don't know. He had not the money for horses. He had 40 kopecks, and that was all that was left after so many years of prosperity. But he had at home an old silver watch, which had long ceased to go. He snatched it up and carried it to a Jewish watchmaker who had a shop in the marketplace, and the Jew gave him 6 rubles for it. And I didn't expect that, cried Mitya ecstatically. He was still in a state of ecstasy. He seized his 6 rubles and ran home. At home he borrowed 3 rubles from the people of the house, who loved him so much that they were pleased to give it to him, though it was all they had. Mitya, in his excitement, told them on the spot that his fate would be decided that day, and he described in desperate haste the whole scheme he had put before Samsonov, the latter's decision, his own hopes for the future, and so on. These people had been told many of their lodger's secrets before, and so looked upon him as a gentleman who was not at all proud, and almost one of themselves. Having thus collected 9 rubles, Mitya sent for posting horses to take him to the Volovya station. This was how the fact came to be remembered and established, that at midday, on the day before the event, Mitya had not a farthing, and that he had sold his watch to get money and had borrowed 3 rubles from his landlord, all in the presence of witnesses. I note this fact later on, it will be apparent why I do so. Though he was radiant with the joyful anticipation that he would at last solve his difficulties, yet, as he drew nearer Volovya station, he trembled at the thought of what Grushenka might be doing in his absence. What if she made up her mind today to go to Fyodor Pavlovich? This is why he had gone off without telling her, and why he left orders with his landlady not to let out where he had gone. Sorry for the yawning. It's really hard to stay awake in this book. This is why he had gone off without telling her why, and he left orders with his landlady not to let out where he had gone if anyone came to inquire for him. I must get back tonight, he repeated. He was jostled along in the cart, and I dare say I shall have to bring this Leah Gavi back here to draw up the deed. So mused Mitya with a throbbing heart, but alas, his dreams were not fated to be carried out. To begin with, he was late, taking a shortcut from Volovya station, which turned out to be 18 versts instead of 12. Secondly, he did not find the priest at home in Ilyenksoy. He had gone off to a neighbouring village, while Mitya, setting off there with the same exhausted horses, was looking for him. It was almost dark. The priest, a shy and amiable-looking little man, informed him at once that though Leah Gavi had been staying with him at first, he was now at Suhoy Pasyoilovk, that he was staying the night in the forester's cottage, and he was buying timber there too. At Mitch's urgent request that he would take him to Leah Gavi at once, and by doing so save him, so to speak, the priest agreed, after some demur, to conduct him to Suhoy Pasyoilovk, His curiosity was obviously aroused, but unluckily he advised their going on foot, as it would not be much of over a verst. Mitcher, of course, agreed and marched off with his yard-long strides, so that the poor priest almost ran after him. He was a very cautious man, though not old. Mitcher at once began talking to him, too, of his plans, nervously and excitedly asking advice in regard to Leah Gabby. Talking all the way, the priest listened attentively but gave little advice. He turned off Mitch's questions with, "I don't know," "I can't say," "How can I tell?" and so on. When Mitcher began to speak of his quarrel with his father over his inheritance, the priest was positively alarmed, as he was in some way dependent on Fyodor Pavlovich. He inquired, however, with surprise, why he called the peasant trader Gortskin Lagavi, and obligingly explained to Mitcher that though the man's name really was Leah Gabby, he was never called so, as he would be grievously offended at that name, and that he must be sure to call him Gortskin. "You'll do nothing with him. He won't even listen to you," said the priest in conclusion. Mitchell was somewhat surprised for a moment and explained that was the Samsonov had called him. On hearing this fact, the priest dropped the subject, though he would have done well to put into words his doubt whether if Samsonov had sent him to that peasant, calling him Leah Gabby, there was no something wrong about it, and he was turning him into ridicule. But Mitcher had no time to pause over such trifles. He hurried, striding along, and only when he reached Suhoi Posilolok did he realize that they had come to one verst, nor one and a half, but at least three. This annoyed him, but he controlled himself. They went into the hut. The forester lived in one half of the hut, and Gortskin was lodging in the other. The better room, the other side of the passage. They went into that room and lighted a tallow candle. The hut was extremely overheated. On the table was a samovar that had gone out, a tray of cups, an empty rum bottle, a bottle of vodka partly full, and some half-eaten crusts of wheaten bread. The visitor himself lay stretched at full length on the bench, with his coat crushed up under his head for a pillow, snoring heavily. Mitcher stood in perplexity. "Of course I must wake him. My business is too important. I've come in such haste. I'm in a hurry to get back today," he said in a great agitation. But the priest and the forester stood in silence, not giving their opinion. Mitcher went up and began trying to wake him himself. He tried vigorously, but the sleeper did not wake. "He's drunk," Mitcher decided. "Good Lord, what am I to do? What am I to do?" And terribly impatient, he began pulling him by the arms, by the legs, shaking his head, lifting him up and making him sit on the bench. Yet, after prolonged exertions, he could only succeed in getting the drunken man to utter absurd grunts and violent but inarticulate oaths. "No, you'd better wait a little," the priest pronounced at last, "for he is obviously not in a fit state. He's been drinking the whole day," the forester chimed in. "Good heavens," cried Mitcher, "if only you knew how important it is to me and how desperate I am." "No, you'd better wait till morning," the priest repeated. "Till morning? Mercy, that's impossible." And in his despair he was on the point of attacking the sleeping man again, but stopped short at once, realizing the uselessness of his effects. The priest said nothing. The sleepy forester looked gloomy. "What terrible tragedies real life contrives for people," said Mitcher in despair. The perspiration was streaming down his face. The priest seized the moment to put before him very reasonably that even if he succeeded in wakening the man, he would still be drunk and incapable of conversation. "And your business is important," he said, "so you'd certainly better put it off till morning." With a gesture of despair, Mitcher agreed. "Father, I will stay here with a light and seize the favourable moment. As soon as he wakes, I'll begin. I'll pay you for the light," he said to the forester. "For the night's lodging, too. You'll remember Dmitri Karamazov, my only father. I don't know what where to do with you, where you will sleep." "No, I'm going home. I'll take his horse and get home," he said, indicating the forester. "And now I'll say goodbye. I wish you all success." So it was settled. The priest rode off on the forester's horse. delighted to escape, though he shook his head uneasily, wondering whether he ought not next day to inform his benefactor Fyodor Pavlovich of his curious incident, or he may, in an unlucky hour, hear of it, be angry and withdraw his favour. The forester, scratching himself, went back to his room without a word, and Mitya sat on the bench to catch the favourable moment, as he expressed it. Profound dejection clung about his soul like a heavy mist, a profound, intense dejection. He sat thinking, but could reach no conclusion. The candle burnt dimly, a cricket chirped. He became insufferably close in the overheated room. He suddenly pictured the garden, the path behind the garden, the door of his father's house mysteriously opening, and Grushenka running in. He leapt up from the bench. "It's a tragedy," he said, grinding his teeth. Mechanically, he went up to the sleeping man and looked in his face. He was a lean, middle-aged peasant with a very long face, flaxen curls, and a long, thin, reddish beard. Wearing a blue cotton shirt and a black waistcoat, from the pocket of which peeped the chain of a silver watch, Mitya looked at his face with intense hatred, and for some unknown reason, his curly hair particularly irritated him. What was insufferably humiliating was that after leaving things of such importance and making such sacrifices, he, Mitya, utterly worn out, should with business of such urgency be standing over this dolt on whom his whole family, his whole fate depended, while he snored as though there was nothing the matter, as though he'd dropped from another planet. "Oh, the irony of fate," cried Mitya, and quite losing his head, he fell again to rousing the tipsy peasant. He roused him with a sort of ferocity, pulling at him, pushed him, even beat him, but after 5 minutes of vain exertions, he returned to his bench in helpless despair, and sat down. "Stupid, stupid," cried Mitya, "and how dishonourable it all is." Something made him mad. His head began to ache horribly. Should he fling it up and go away altogether, he wondered. "No, wait till tomorrow. I'll stay on purpose. What else did I come for? Besides, I've no means of going. How am I to get away from here? Oh, the eudocracy of it, idiocy of it." But his head ached more and more. He sat without moving, the unconsciously dozed off, and fell asleep as he sat. He seemed to have slept for 2 hours or more. He was waked up by his head aching so unbearably that he could have screamed. There was a hammering in his temples. The top of his head ached, and it was a long time before he could wake up fully and understand what had happened to him. At last he realized that the room was full of charcoal fumes from the stove, and that he might die of suffocation, and the drunken peasant still lay snoring. The candle guttered and was about to go out. Mitya cried out and ran staggering across the passage into the forester's room. The forester waked up at once, but hearing that the other room was full of fumes, to Mitch's surprise and annoyance, accepted the fact with strange unconcern, though he didn't go to see it. "But he's dead, and what am I to do then?" cried Mitya frantically. They threw open the door, opened a window and the chimney. Mitya brought a pail of water from the passage. First he wetted his own head, then finding a large rag of some sort, dipped it into the water and put it on Leah Gavi's head. The forester still treated the matter contemptuously, and when he opened the window, he said grumpily, "It'll be all right now." He went back to sleep, leaving Mitya a lighted lantern. Mitya fussed about the drunken peasant for half an hour, wetting his head and gravely resolved not to sleep all night, but he was so worn out that when he sat down for a moment to take a breath, he closed his eyes, unconsciously stretched himself full length on the bench, and slept like the dead. It was dreadfully late, and he waked. It was somewhere about 9 o'clock. The sun was shining brightly in the two little windows of the hut. The curly-haired peasant was sitting on the bench and had his coat on. He had another samovar and bottle in front of him. Yesterday's bottle had already been finished, and the new one was more than half empty. Mitya jumped up and saw at once that the cursed peasant was drunk again, hopelessly and incurably. He stared at him for a moment with wide-opened eyes. The peasant was silently and slyly watching him with insulting composure and even a sort of contemptuous condescension, so Mitya fancied. He rushed up to him. "Excuse me, you see, you've most likely heard from the forester here in the hut. I am Lieutenant Dmitri Karamazov, the son of the old Karamazov whose cops you are buying." "That's a lie," said the peasant calmly and confidently. "A lie? You know Fyodor Pavlovich?" "I don't know any of your Fyodor Pavloviches," said the peasant, speaking thickly. "You're bargaining with him for the cops. Do wake up and collect yourself. Father Pavel of Ilyinkso brought me here. You wrote to Samsonov, and he has sent me to you, Mitcher gasped breathlessly. You're lying, Liar Gabby blurted out again. Mitcher's legs went cold. For mercy's sake, it isn't a joke. You're drunk, perhaps. You can speak and understand, or else I understand nothing. You're lying. Wait, did I read that bit? Yes. You're a painter. For mercy's sake, I am Karamazov, Dmitri Karamazov. I have an offer to make you, an advantageous offer. Very advantageous, concerning the cops. The peasant stroked his beard importantly. No, you've contracted for the job and turned out a scamp. You're a scoundrel. I assure you, you're mistaken, cried Mitya, wringing his hands in despair. The peasant still stroked his beard and suddenly screwed up his eyes cunningly. No, you see, you show me this. You tell me the law that allows roguery, do you hear? You're a scoundrel. Do you understand that? Mitya stepped back gloomily and suddenly something seemed to hit him on the head, as he said afterwards. In an instant, a light seemed to dawn in his mind. A light was kindled and grasped at it all. He stood stupefied, wondering how he, after all, a man of intelligence, could have yielded to such folly, have been led into such an adventure, and have kept it all up for almost 24 hours, fussing around his lager, wetting his head. Why, the man's drunk, dead drunk, and you'll go on drinking now for a week. What's the use of waiting here, and what is this if Samsonov sent me here on purpose? What is she? Oh, God, what have I done? The peasant sat watching him and grinning. Another time Mitya might have killed the fool in a fury, but now he felt as weak as a child. He went quietly to the bench, took up his overcoat, put it on without a word, and went out of the hut. He did not find the forester in the next room. There was no one there. He took 50 kopecks in small change out of his pocket and put them in the table for his night's lodgings. The candle and the trouble he had given. Coming out of the hut, he saw nothing but forest all around. He walked at hazard, not knowing which way to turn out of the hut, to the right or to the left. Hurrying there the evening before with the priest, he had not noticed the road. He had no revengeful feeling for anybody, even for Samsonov, in his heart. He strode along a narrow forest path, aimless, dazed, without heeding where he was going. A child could have knocked him down, so weak was he in body and soul. He got out of the forest somehow, however, and a vista of fields, bare after the harvest, stretched as far as the eye could see. What despair! What death all round, he repeated, striding on and on. He was saved by meeting an old merchant who was being driven across country in a hired trap. When he overtook him, Mitya asked the way. It turned out that the old merchant, too, was going to Volovya. After some discussion, Mitya got into the trap. 3 hours later, they arrived at Volovya. Mitya at once ordered posting horses to drive to the town and suddenly realized that he was appallingly hungry. While the horses were being harnessed, an omelette was prepared for him. He ate it all in an instant, ate a huge chunk of bread, ate a sausage and swallowed 3 glasses of vodka. After eating, his spirits and his heart grew lighter. He flew towards the town, urged on the driver, and suddenly made a new and unalterable plan to procure the accursed money before evening, and to think only to think that a man's life should be ruined for the sake of that paltry 3,000. He cried contemptuously, "I'll settle it today," and if it had not been for the thought of Grushenka and of what might have happened to her, which never left him, he would perhaps have become quite cheerful again, but the thought of her was stabbing him to the heart every moment like a sharp needle. At last they arrived, and Mitya at once ran to Grushenka. All right, there we go. Another chapter down. Have your say at reddit.com/r/thehemingwaylist, and I'll see you tomorrow.